Welcome back to Miami Nice.
Welcome back, Katie Walsh. How are you? We're back. We're back, baby. We're back.
I'm good. How are you?
It's 2020 and everyone's having one. And it's been crazy. We're surviving. We're surviving.
Yeah.
Well, we're so excited to be back for Miami Nice. And I'm just going to jump in and then Katie is going to tag on this. We are so happy that you guys are listening. We're so happy that all the great feedback that we received and response we received to the original series, both in video and audio form, particularly a lot more listens than views, but that's great. We're just happy that you engage with the show. We're back now in a slightly different format. When Katie and I decided to do Miami Nice together, it was kind of a way for us to blatantly ignore the pandemic swelling around each of us in both of our countries at that time. It was about us having a few drinks and watching a movie that gave us a deep amount of escapist comfort, where lines like, we go from zero to high order violence like that, and where people say, you get to town in Miami, and those things. We just enjoyed spending time, having a few drinks, unpacking the movie together. But, you know, the world has changed. It's a crazy 2020. It's an unbelievably turbulent time for both civil rights and, you know, government powers. And police are a particularly problematic entity in pop culture. And what's cool about Michael Mann movies, as you would have heard when Katie did our sort of reintroduction to one of our final episodes we recorded before our hiatus, you would have heard us talk about coming to terms with that. And what's great about Michael Mann movies is that he does have a complicated relationship with police. And even as far back as Thief, he casts all the police officers as actual former thieves in Chicago and casts all the thieves that currently working in Chicago as police officers. He loves those games. And so we wanted to find a way to talk about this movie and say everything we wanted to say on the show, but it's not really as fun to have a few drinks about it and get not serious about it. We wanted to talk about the themes of the movie, but not really have that on our heads, I suppose. Is that the best way, Katie, that we can say that?
Yeah, I think you're dead on in sort of what we've been grappling with this film. And, you know, it was hard, especially for me in the beginning of June, and I explained all of this on my intro on the last episode, but, you know, I was like, is this copaganda? And
yes.
Having thought and sat with this for a long time, like, it's not, because it's not trying to just say these are all moral people and what they're doing is right. It's like grappling with the complexities of that. And I think that there is still merit in, you know, unpacking this movie and talking about how it works inexplicably and talking about its relationship to the series and how, you know, Mann's film is like so much grittier and more nuanced and complex than necessarily what the series showed us. So, and there's just so many people that love this movie and want to talk about it. So
an unbelievable thing happened, and we say it in the upcoming show, but there was a tsunami of people that reached out to us when we kicked off the show. Firstly, just liking our great artwork by Garth Franklin and Katie and I doing the great poses. But secondly, they're like, a couple of people actually said, we don't need to do the podcast. You made this art. That's enough. So thank you in advance for that. But also there's some amazing people who have this same connection with this movie. This movie is having a moment all over again. Seemed to have a moment at the 10-year anniversary, but it just continues to have this moment. People keep engaging with it. People keep talking about it. And I think when you're trapped inside your house and there's no new content coming out, of course you revisit the movies that make you feel good.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I mean, just read Bill Gabbieri's Twitter, you're just going to see him like say, I just watched Miami Vice again. Like, I don't even know if I'm watching any new movies. I just may be watching Miami Vice again. And so I feel like it's those things that keep coming up. So we've reached out to all those people who reached out to us. We have an amazing lineup of guests.
I'm so excited about who we're going to talk to. And it just felt like if we didn't talk to these people, like, we wouldn't have fulfilled our mission.
We've escaped. We were the only government agency that was escaped it, and now we're deputized under federal to fulfill our mission.
We had to get all of these people on to talk about Miami Vice. Otherwise, it just would have felt unfinished. It would have felt, you know, like we hadn't fully done what we set out to do. So I'm super excited. We're going to have guests now, and we've an awesome guest today.
Oh my God.
Absolutely. The very first DM I received was from this guest.
I can't.
An amazing filmmaker and a friend. And yeah.
I can't tell you guys how excited. We've just recorded the interview with this guest, and it's such a joy. Like, the joy on my face and on Katie's face and on our guest's face talking about this, it's a heartwarming thing of someone, you know, of a now a really emerging talented filmmaker talking about their relationship with this movie. And we couldn't be happier that this is our first interview. So
it's perfect. I mean, and perfect. As you will hear in the interview, Miami Vice was film school for our guest, who's now this like amazing award-winning filmmaker. And that guest is Bill Ross of the Ross Brothers, amazing documentarians and filmmakers. And we have an awesome conversation for you guys. So it's going to be great.
Let's go from zero. It is great. Zero to high order interview. Just like that.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Far too kind.
Welcome to Miami Nice. We are back and we have our very first guest, which is super exciting. And we're going to have a series of guests on Miami Nice, but Bill Ross had to be our very first guest because he was probably the first person to ask me to be a guest.
Hey, when I saw you tweet about it, I love this film, and I have a weird knowledge about it. So I threw my hat in the ring.
Yes. And we're so glad that you did. And we're so excited to get into all of your experiences with this movie because you did edit the trailer.
I was an assistant editor, but I was right there for all the business going on. Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to get into it. And if you guys do not know who Bill Ross is, well, I just don't know what to tell you, but Bill and his brother Turner, the Ross brothers, are amazing documentarians. I absolutely love their films. 4-5-3-6-5, amazing movie. Chapatulas was the first movie of yours that I saw. Western, obsessed. That's newly on Criterion Channel?
Yeah, it came out in the last week, yeah.
Oh, I love it. You guys have to check that movie out.
Western went to Criterion? That's great. I'm on that too. Yep, okay, great, awesome.
Contemporary Color, an amazing David Byrne concert film. And then this year they had Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets, which premiered at Sundance. And if you miss Bars, which I know we're all missing dive bars right now, you got to watch Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets, which is a love letter to bar culture and bar life. And Blake and I love this quote from our friend of pod, Matt Zollersites, which describes the film as bursting with humanity, grounded in humility, and in love with the poetry of faces. Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets is a classic indie film that will irritate or mystify some viewers while inspiring evangelical fervor in others. So you can rent it on iTunes right now. So go ahead and watch all of those films by the Ross Brothers. But today we're talking about Michael Mann's 2006 epic, Miami Vice. Yes. So, Bill, I just read the profile of you and your brother that was in LA Times, written by my friend Amy Kaufman. Mm-hmm. And in that profile, she says that you guys ultimately left LA after you were cutting trailers and doing things like the Miami Vice trailer. And then you realized that you weren't getting anything sort of like creatively fulfilling out of that. So did Miami Vice really drive you out of LA and into New Orleans to make documentaries?
No, not at all. I mean, that was the first real job, I mean, like industry job I ever had. So I was fresh out of college. Turner and I were working, like factory jobs, whatever we could do to pay the rent. And I started as a runner at this trailer house. Running, back in the day before like uploading things quickly. We were running like tapes all around LA, worked my way up to be an assistant editor. And right around that time, we find out that we're going to get the Miami Vice trailer.
Now,
huge, huge Michael Mann fan. And Blake, I have to give you some credit. Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets was a very hard edit. And one heat minute, I listened to
Oh my God.
All the way through. It got me through the entire edit of that film.
Ew. That's so lovely. Oh, that I'm completely chuffed with that, but you made an amazing film. So, that's why we love Matt's quote, but thank you for saying that. That's great. So you're running physical tapes.
Physical tapes, like all over LA, to all the studios of each version of every trailer, TV spot. We find out, just as, you know, I get promoted to be an assistant, that, Miami Vice is coming in. All us assistants are very excited. And the head assistant, who's been, an assistant for a couple years, is very peculiar, is summoned to Michael Mann's office, where he will read the script, because Michael Mann will not give the script. He will not hand it over. So this fella needs to memorize the script. He can take no notes.
Whoa.
He has to memorize the script because Michael Mann will be sending dailies every day over. And so from this dude's mind, he has to piece together what all these dailies, where they need to go and what the storyline is.
No pressure.
No pressure at all. So this poor guy comes back. And he's very, it took hours for him to read this thing, because he said it was so precise that, and it was so long, because any weapon that was used went into such great detail in the script, as, make, model, serial number of, like, what gun was being used, whatever, what kind of boat,
Go fast boat.
Yeah. That was shorter. That was shorter than the gun descriptions.
Yeah. So, Jake Gyllenhaal in Zodiac, he has to run back to where we're working and scribble down the script from what he remembers. So then, this was very exciting, Katie. This is why
I'm loving this. I'm like soaking it all in.
If I'm telling you, Bill, if the podcast ended now, my week is made. Like, just that visual of your poor editor friend, like, literally frazzled Robert Graysmith running back to the script. Like, I've just read a Michael Mann script. Now go write it, because that's the only memory that I can have. That is the best image.
Right.
That's an old time.
He runs in and we're all asking him questions, like, all the stuff. So he has to lock himself into a room so he can do this. So as the dailies come in, we're getting the dailies at the same time that the actual editor is getting it. So our task is to cut the movie. So we cut, our version of the movie based off of this other assistant editor's notes. So I actually got to cut a version
of my
life, just from the raw footage. So that was, at that time, being, very early 20s, was like the highlight of my life at that point.
Oh my God.
So it's nice to be on at a trailer house, but
I don't really know much about how trailers are cut. I mean, is that typical to, like, basically?
Absolutely not.
Okay. I'm like, do most trailer houses watch the dailies? Like, that seems.
Yeah. Dailies. Yes. Mm-hmm. But you would usually have a script. There would be.
You would usually have a script. You'd not have to memorize it in a 2-hour sitting.
And you would get that script before you got footage, and based off that script, there would be copywriters that would write a trailer before you. It comes in all different ways, but for something like this high level, it can get pretty funky. So.
And Bill, correct me if I'm wrong, because you'd know more about this from being in there. Some directors are really fastidious, and obviously Michael Mann is one of these guys, but some directors, like, I think it's Paul Thomas Anderson, doesn't let anyone else cut his trailers. Like, he comes to the cut of the trailer knowing what he wants to show. So there are certain filmmakers who actually bypass the standard process from marketing and say, no,
yes,
I want you to show this, and that's what we're going to show.
Right. So that, as far as I know, that wasn't the case here, but he was heavily, heavily involved. There were funny moments during this whole thing, like Linkin Park came in to okay that their song got used. So that was a funny day.
We're obsessed with that. I mean, I'm personally obsessed with that opening shot and the theatrical cut it just drops into the Numb Encore remix.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, it's so funny how, like, an opening mood setting moment like that can, like, completely get you ready. Like you can, it's funny because Katie and I have shared that experience talking together. It's like when that happened to both of us, we're like, oh, I'm in. And some people are like, what the hell's going on? And I think if you have either one of those reactions, it's kind of like you're prepared for what this movie's going to be. And if you're in, like, you're like, oh, I don't care. I'm in. That's so great. All right. Oh my God. We have to slow down, Bill, because there's just too much. There's just too much.
Go ahead. Yeah.
So you guys are getting the dailies. You're cutting this thing together. It's flowing as it should be flowing, I guess, because with the dailies, it's like the schedule is going along and you guys are assembly cutting this thing together. At what point in that, like when you guys cut your version, is it a version that the editors sit down with? Is it like drastically different from the version that we've seen? Like, is there heaps of different elements that maybe weren't included? Because I guess where we're rolling up to, and we will eventually get to this point, but we know that there is a point in the film and a point in your friend's crazy whiteboard, you know, the garage in the first season of True Detective moment of assembling this script that we know that there is a completely different ending that existed in scripted form. So I guess like how far along that process were you guys in cutting when you guys had a sort of a chunky enough trailer, I guess, to start off with?
Right. So we were actually cutting the film quicker, if I remember correctly, we were cutting it quicker than the actual studio was. So we were sharing that cut and that cut was going back and forth. I was tasked with cutting what ultimately got cut, but that opening boat race, which I believe is in the director's cut.
Yes, oh, yeah. Gorgeous.
It's amazing. And there was just seemingly thousands of hours of coverage on that.
Oh, my God.
So I was just like, you know, I think all the other assistant wrote down was like, there's a boat race and then they, you know, get off the boat. So I'm just like trying to cut together
stuff. There's a boat race.
Yeah,
it's 12 pages of a script, and he's like, "There's a boat race."
Yeah, and then that goes into the club scene, which ultimately is much better, much more captivating open. I guess I'm going on a tangent here. I will get back to the question, but I do remember in that opening club scene when you first meet Colin Farrell, he walks to the bar and he orders mojitos, right?
Two of them.
two of them. So he goes up.
And a gin and tonic.
And a gin and tonic, yes. But the line he goes up, he says, you know, he's like, hey, darling. And then he's like, you know, two mojitos, whatever. And she says lemon or lime. And he, in the dailies, he quickly rebuttals and says, lime. You don't make mojitos with lemons, darling. And so it's like, like really bewilderingly dickish. So you're just like, oh, that's a weird first foot to get off of with old Colin here. So luckily they cut the other part of that. I'm sure they tested it. And we're just like, he's immediately unlikable. I remember that big.
It would really be like negging, like because he and then ultimately flirts with her, which is great. Like it's like straight away, you know, this guy is just a relentless flirt, and he's a ladies' man, and he's like he enjoys this part of his profession. But it's like, yeah, that is the most dickish line of all time.
Yeah,
I think maybe when bars open, all three of us should test it. If anyone ever asks if it's lemon or lime, you don't make a mojito with lime.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's gonna flirt with you if you were to accost the bartender.
No.
Yeah, he ultimately goes with what line? The you got your tan in Miami.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So those lines were always in there. It was just the, you know, the mansplaining how to make a mojito part that was.
Oh man, I wish I could get my eyes on those dailies.
Oh my God.
Oh, they're fantastic. And the coverage in the club is just so much. And they actually, again,
Bill, you've cut so many things, and especially Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets. It's so goddamn hard to make in a false sense. This is why documentary cinema does it much better and actually like kind of recorrects your eyes, but movie club scenes so often are terrible, like just almost universally terrible about mood and space and like just the energy of like a great club. If you ever said to a friend like, oh, we went to a great club, But Miami Vice gets it. Like, I don't know what it is. Like, the coverage that they got and the space that is created and the editing pace, it just feels like, oh, that feels like a club. Like, it actually feels like a club that people are dancing in and that people are bumping against each other and, you know, trying to get into. Like, I don't know about the energy of that whole scene. It's just so awesome. Like, all the work that you got, obviously, got to see them do and then did yourself in cutting some of the trailer. But, yeah, I don't know what it is. It just feels different to me than so many other movies.
In those scenes, they are setting up a scenario where they, you know, it's not silent. They're not like silently dancing like, you know, every other film would probably do. And there's, you know, probably, well, I don't know how many cameras, but I mean, it's getting covered in a major way. But they were like blasting music. So it really had like a real, in the dailies, like kind of club vibe. And it's when you get into the close-ups for like dialogue or whatever that, you know, it's, you know, people are silently dancing in the background, but it seemingly tried to, you know, make it feel genuine. And that Linkin Park song is actually played in, if I'm remembering this correctly, this was, you know, 15 years ago or whatever, but that Linkin Park song is being played while they're shooting. And I think, so either Michael Mann has an affinity toward that song or it just, I don't know where it's being pulled from, but yeah.
We talk a lot about the music in this podcast because I'm obsessed with it in the sense that it's both great and terrible.
Well, just like everything in this film, it's terrible. Like, it shouldn't work. None of this should work.
No.
Like, unlike Heat, where I just feel like Heat's perfect, like, so many things in this movie should not work. They don't work, but somehow, like, for instance, like, when Colin Farrell, you know, is being at, he says, well, my mommy and daddy know me, you know, or like Jamie Foxx says, let's take it to the limit one more time.
Yeah.
You're just like, who wrote this? But yet I find this to be the most rewatchable Michael Mann film. I don't know.
That's the thing, is like, everyone is sort of like, why does this work? We don't know what's going on, but we just want to rewatch it over and over again. And it's got the vibe and the energy. And like, you don't even have to totally follow what's going on. No. You just have to like be there and like be present. And that's what makes it work.
See, Bill and Katie, you guys would know this with Heat. It's like, some people who are passive fans of Heat and not quite obsessives like myself or folk who have listened to the show, is you're like, no, it's really quotable. And people kind of like, there's something about the way the script is written that it's kind of hidden quotable. Like, it's quotable all the time, but it doesn't jump out at you like, let's push it to the limit one more time. Like, you know, no, it's not a boat, it's an apartment building. Like, you know, these things, these lines, like in my head, when like my friend's got a boat, I'm like, well, if that boat's not moving, it looks like an apartment building. Like, I can't help myself. It's so dumb, but it's like, I agree with you. There's something about, it's like, there's this one extra layer or extra layer of emphasis or extra layer of delivery that like every line in this movie just doesn't, like, it just takes it to, it does take it to the limit one more time. Like, but all Michael Mann movies are quotable. That's the thing, is like, the real Michael Mann heads get it, but this movie just does something else. It's doing something else with every line. Everything. It's Hannah Miami.
Disco guy. I mean,
I'm a disco guy.
So, Bill, when you were like putting this assembly cut together, were you guys like, this is genius? Or were you kind of like, we don't know?
Yes, great question. Great question.
No, I mean, we were laughing at all these lines. I mean, it looked cool. You know, the color palette of the film is amazing.
Amazing.
I think that we were like, I'm not sure Colin Farrell is going to work.
You know? Oh, great. Yes, because I was going to get to this. I was going to get to this with you, Bill.
We were like, what? First of all, what does he look like? and his line deliveries are insane. So we were, you know, I remember laughing a lot at particularly him.
Oh, my God.
But again, in the final version, I love him, you know?
Yeah. He does really, I mean, not to say it again, but he takes it to the limit.
Oh, my God.
You know, you are like, what's with this hair? What's with this mustache? And then it just somehow weirdly gels.
Yep.
I think it's his, and I want to pronounce it right for both of our dialects. Like, obviously, is like his pallor. Like there's something about his skin. Yep. And that, again, talking about bloody nose, people who drink have that like, that like booze bloat. Like you got a bit of booze bloat. Like if you've been on a, you know, I think you guys call it like, we call it here Bucks. Like, is it a Bucks party or is it like a bachelor party in the States? Yeah. Right. So we could say, so like, if you go out, there's been times where I've like, my friends have had bachelor party weekends and you go out and you drink for days and whatever, and you come back and you feel like Colin Farrell looks in this movie. Like he's like bloated and sweaty and like you just feel like a bag of shit, but like you're dressing in nice clothes because you're going out, because you're going out with your friends, but you feel like, you feel sweaty, it feels hot, like you're just that little bit more swollen in the face because you've just had way too much booze. And so when I watch him in this movie, I'm just like, there's something about it, man. There's just something about it. Like this guy's got it. He's like that raconteur at a bar. Like he's just, I want to listen to him. I want to watch everything he's doing, because he admits himself now, like retroactively, he's like, look, I watch this movie, not like I'm ever, he doesn't really watch himself that much. He's like, I don't really watch myself, but particularly for this film, I don't actually watch that as me. I watch it as a completely other guy who's making all these choices and like, oh, he made some good choices, but he's drunk off his ass every day. He has no memory of it. Like, which is kind of sad, but it's also kind of like, like it's never going to happen again. He can't, if they made a sequel, he can't get back to that guy. Like it's a different guy. It's amazing.
Yeah. He's, I didn't realize that he was that party boy at the time.
Yeah.
I think he went to rehab like right after.
Okay. All right.
We've also received some reports that, he was partying with, Diego Maradona.
Whoa.
Like, I can't remember. Wait, Katie. I can't remember.
Of course.
Okay.
So
Bill, what I wanted to say at the start that we didn't quite get to, which I'm so happy. Firstly, I just want to say I'm really happy that you're on the show. I'm so happy that you're here. But there was a tsunami of DMs that came in when Katie and I announced this show. There was a tsunami. And Katie and I had this wonderful, I almost feel like it should have been published, conversation about all these great people. You being the very first cab off that rank. We're like, these are people who want to talk to us about the show. And then we got a random guy who just happened to be a fan of Heat and Michael Mann and this movie, who got in touch with Katie and I and was like, I know that while they were shooting in South America, Colin Farrell was partying with Diego Maradona. And we went, wait, how do you know that? And he's like, I'll show you. And like, what was it, a day later, Katie? We had the photos, pap photos from outside a club in South America where Colin Farrell's there with Diego Maradona. And like, again, it's not Colin Farrell. It's Sonny Crockett.
Yeah. That's cocaine bloat right there.
Like straight in there. And it's like, oh my God. And so he sent the photos. And
without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Yeah, so...
we take all tips. We take party reports.
Unbelievable.
But yeah, there's something about it. Like, I think also we've talked about this film sort of in relationship to the series and how the series was so shiny and beautiful and Don Johnson was such a pretty boy.
Oh, I got a Don Johnson tale for you.
Oh,
first day in LA, me and Turner moved out there. We went to the Troubadour because our dad, who had been in the Marine Corps, and he was stationed in San Diego, he said his favorite place to go was the Troubadour. We'd drive up 5 and go to the Troubadour. So we went to the Troubadour, and shit you not, we're walking up. Don Johnson walks out, hops into a convertible, and tears off. First riding in LA, right there.
You're like, we're here, baby.
Like, this is how LA works? Yeah. Wow. Okay. I guess
coast to coast. Sunny is in Miami as he is in LA. Yes. What a baller.
Sorry,
Don Johnson.
No, I just was gonna say that like I think that the film is like, I think, man, you know, he didn't really do the series. And I think that he the movie was something that he was like, I have to do this, and I'm going to do it authentically, and I'm going to talk about all these gangs and the real way that drug cartels work, and it's going to be like gritty and realistic and not, you know, shiny and pastel the way the series was. But I almost feel like Colin Farrell like method acted his way into like who the real Sonny Crockett would be. Just like too tan, weird blonde hair, bloated, like on the edge, like very, like he, you know, they caught him at just the right ripeness for this character to work the way that it does. I think
the lie of movies, Katie, and this is what I think you're getting at. The lie of movies is undercover people are always sexy. And now they are good looking, like a lot of undercover people, but there's something that there has to be something sketchy about you. Like one of the great things that I know you've written about it recently is the, and we've talked about him on this show many times. It's like the whole Tom Sizemore part in Point Break. Like when he's in Point Break and he's like bleached hair and disgusting, you're like, that guy's an undercover. Like he looks disgusting. Right. And how method Tom Sizemore may or may have not been during that performance is a completely new podcast that we're not doing just right now. But I think that that's what he nails. Like he gets that, like, he's sketchy. He looks dirty. Like you're like, this guy's up to something, man. He's like, he's not, you know, he makes everyone feel great. Okay. We have to get back to the chronology here really quickly and just go, you're cutting this together. It's all going along. Crazy time in America. We talked about it a couple of times on the podcast. Hurricanes happening. You guys are getting footage. It's all coming in. When is the moment, or is there a moment, Bill, that you guys remember like everything stopping? Where, like during production that says, okay, or completely changing, or your friend having to go back and read a revision of the script. Do you guys remember that in the editing suite?
Well, that time was weird for me too, because Turner, I'm here in New Orleans. Turner was working on a film here and I get a phone call and he says he's working on a Denzel Washington, Tony Scott picture.
Man on Fire?
No, I wish it was Man on Fire.
I'm like, I have to look it up.
Hold on. Why am I forgetting this? He lives down the street. Maybe I'll just yell at him. Deja vu. Okay, so he calls me up and he's like, hey, storm's coming. Storm, not uncommon. And he's like, they're going to get a private jet and, you know, fly everybody back to LA for the weekend. So I'm like, sweet, we'll party all weekend. And, you know, ends up being Katrina and everything's fucked. So that was a weird time for me because he immediately turned back with another buddy of ours from New Orleans and they drove back here for Katrina. And I honestly, my mind was on that. I don't really recall when I went back into work, like what exactly.
I don't blame you. The whole world was in turmoil at that moment.
I don't remember because I know that really threw production off. And I know that, you know, Jamie Foxx refused to do a lot of shit at the end.
Yeah.
Like, what do y'all know about that? Because I know that they had to rewrite a lot of stuff.
Well, a security guard got shot.
Right. I knew that.
Am I getting this right, Blake? The chronology, like a guy gets shot in where, like, Paraguay or Dominican Republic or something. I'm not going.
So they had basically what was happening is they actually had family and friends around when they were shooting, and they had hired, from what I understand, private security personnel. And there was a fracas between private security personnel and people trying to get a look on the set, because obviously they're shooting in a place that doesn't usually have movies and it's obviously got all the lights and the trailers and all of the paraphernalia. Someone comes to get on set, someone gets shot. In that moment, I think it's funny. I've now since listened to another podcast and read a story that Colin Farrell's dad was on set that day, and he and Gong Li and Colin Farrell all just hung out together, just sort of heard a gunshot, thought it was a bit weird, went and sort of stayed in their trailers, didn't really do anything, waited. And apparently in that moment when there was that shooting, Jamie Foxx picked up, got his whole entourage and just left and refused to come back to that country again. Yeah. And in that moment, that then caused the rewrite, because part of what was going to happen, and this is what we hear was going to happen, is the big Archangel Jesus de Montoya's compound that was set over the Iguazu Falls or near Iguazu in the, is it Cinque del Este? Like that, apparently that's where that was going to go down from what I, and again, this is all sort of hearsay and sort of rumor and things like that, because there's no one really who's gone on the record from the production that said, yeah, it was exactly this and then we changed it. But then they made it in, he said, I'm not shooting unless it's in America. And then that's why they brought it back to Miami.
I see. But is it the same scenario where Naomi Harris gets kidnapped?
All of that happens, all the same kidnapping scenario. But I think that what it was at the end was like a big action orientated sequence that happens down in South America, as opposed to the confrontation that happens with Yero and his men is right. Not there. They all sort of rush away to the other country and then they go down there and then there's a big shootout that ends the film, I think. But that, I think it was, they only talk about the climax, which is why, you know, it's relatively small scale climax, really. Like in the grand scheme of the movie, it's just at a shipyard. Like they just sort of change, they swapped out the setting. So, and even what's weird also is, you remember that final scene before the shipyard, they're actually in an airplane hangar getting ready for a final shootout.
Yeah.
But then they go to a shipyard. I've always thought that was weird. Like, I was like, why are they getting, like, I know that that's like a stupid detail to get hooked on, but I've always gone like, why are they in an airplane hangar and then going to, and then in my head, I'm like, oh, maybe they were in the hangar because that's where, you know, their undercover operations are in the hangar. So, oh, okay, that makes sense. But it kind of does look like, oh, they're all getting ready in the hangar to get in a plane to go down to South America to like infiltrate this space.
That would make more sense, yes.
Then turning around to go to a shipyard.
Yeah, yeah. I've never thought about that where you're like, yeah, why do they go from the airplane hangar to the shipyard? But somehow I just went along with it.
Somehow.
I mean, there are other steps along the way in the film that you just go with. So exactly. By that point, you're ready.
Yeah, let's keep going.
So my favorite parts of the movie are when Colin, Sonny, and Gong Li go to Cuba, and it's just like vibes and
where they don't like his passport.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
But like the dancing, I mean, we've talked about the dance scene a bunch.
The Habamasa is my cousin. it's amazing. It's amazing. She's literally doing it phonetically, which is unbelievable. Like I don't understand how. I even get annoyed with Australians who do bad American accents in movies. Like I hate it. And I can't believe that she learned how to speak English phonetically to like do any, and then they're like, not only are you going to speak English, but I need you to do a Cuban accented Chinese English person. Right. Oh, okay, cool.
It doesn't surprise me that the club scene was shot with music and authentically and stuff. Cause another thing that we talk about a lot is just like how, like if you listen to the commentary, man is just like, this poster is from this place and this mural I had recreate. Like he is so detail oriented. I mean, I'm just wondering, I know Colin and Gong Li trained for 3 months to learn salsa dancing. Like I have to wonder what those club scenes looked like too, like from just the dailies.
I don't recall. I wasn't assigned those scenes. I can imagine. I mean, they look much more choreographed than that opening club scene.
Right.
But yeah, I didn't cut on those, so I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah,
I'm guessing, you know, it's probably shot similarly where the music's on and they're just letting them go and they're mostly shooting it like a doc.
Yeah, that's what it feels like. Yeah. Almost like concert film because they have like a live band there and everything.
Yeah.
They got too good almost. they got so good, like well, 3 months so of destiny.
They got found out.
Yeah, exactly. Bill, give us some more highlights. Give us like you know, because we had that massive interruption. Everything changes. You know, the Jamie Foxx leaves. When everything picks back up again, what are your memories of like finally delivering a trailer, people receiving it, like, you know, running it around? Like, do you have any memories of like what those moments were like at the end? Because I'm really keen to like, because I guess I try and cast my mind back because I wasn't, you know, I wasn't like a fan of the Miami Vice series. Like in Australia, it was on.
Yeah, it was on.
I wasn't a fan. I wasn't huge, but I was a Michael Mann fan. So knowing you had a new movie and then Miami Vice and you're like, oh, cool. So what was the ending, especially of that production of the trailer and things like that? Like, was there like, Because
well, there was this great anticipation as we were getting closer and closer and closer, and you know, phone call, back and forth to Michael Mann's studio or whatever. We kept thinking he was going to come in. We thought there was going to be an appearance where he just sat in the editing bay and like locked it down 24th hour, you know, kind of thing. Because Linkin Park had already come in. We're like, well, this is, you know, what is
above Linkin Park?
Michael Mann. I guess this line doesn't make sense. I love the line where the guy goes, they go from zero to high order violence just like that. And he snaps. Why are you doing this to me, baby? I love that guy. Like, it's such
Eddie Marzin, baby. Oh my God.
I just thought it was going to go to the next level. And we were just sitting in our little editor nerd section being like, oh man, is today the day, you know, cause we knew it was going to finish any day. We thought Michael Mann might come in, give a stamp of approval. Never happened, unfortunately. But yeah, when the trailer came out, you know, that was the first like, you know, cool thing I'd ever worked on. So yeah. when it popped up on Apple trailers or whatever, we just watched it on loop, and it was, you know, we sent it to all our friends and it was cool as hell. And then we worked right next to ArcLight Hollywood, and just when it came out, we after work the first night of premiere, we all went over there and watched it and saw the final cut of the film, and yeah, it was cool as hell.
That's so fun.
Yeah. So
fun. amazing. Amazing. And when you guys saw it, you had a weird intimate relationship with this thing, like seeing it go through, seeing dailies, being part of it, seeing Linkin Park, like, you know, like all those things happening. When you watched it, did you dig it, and did the audience around you dig it, or were they kind of like, because I had, you know, Katie and I have talked a couple of times about our first experiences. Like, I walked out and I was like, oh, that was great. And the whole audience, all I heard was like, can you believe that guy's mustache? Like, what is going on? Like, they could not get over the look. It was like almost like a barrier of entry was a problem. And like a lot of people I walked out with like had a bad experience coming out. So I wonder like what that was like for you.
I mean, we were all kind of giddy. And I, like, to me, it was like my first lesson in editing, really. You know, it's like to see what a master editor, their choices were after, you know, making whatever ridiculous young person choices I made. But it was, yeah, how it taught me like how a movie comes together and like, you know, what you got to do in order to advance plot and, you know, what doesn't work. Like the boat race, in my gut, I was like, this goes on too long. It doesn't really, you know, it doesn't really advance anything. It puts you in that world, but you immediately go to the club. So that already drops you in the world. So I guess in my gut, I knew that was right. And to see that choice made was cool. My favorite thing was that great sex scene with Jamie Foxx and Naomi Harris, where he like quits on her.
Yes.
And she's kind of disappointed. And he's like, just kidding.
Yeah.
So that was a total ad lib. And like in the dailies, I think you remember you like hearing people laugh. And I was like, that's such a good moment, you know? Like, and they put it in and it's perfect.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah.
That is.
Yeah.
Because how tiresome and awkward must be doing that sex scene, like the sex scene over and over again. So like that's actually what we talked about in this, you know, one of our episodes about like, adult relationships in this movie are good. Like the sex is like good. It doesn't feel bad. It's like, it's sensual. It's exciting. Like everyone's enjoying it. And that's a fun scene because it's like a real it feels like a real relationship. It feels like a stupid game you would play with your partner, as opposed to, you know, like just like one night stand from a girl who just took you to Cuba for the afternoon. But it's a little bit more exciting when you're going to Cuba with a girl, you know?
Yeah, we talked in the previous episode about how the like it feels like an adult relationship where they're equals, where, you know, there's a real intimacy there because he is playing around and joking and stuff. And so I love that was an ad lib. That's amazing.
Yeah. And it just, you know, it's obviously the scene that sets up the relationship that pays off later. But in any other film, it would just sort of be standard stuff. But just to have that little moment of, humor in there. It said so much about their relationship.
Totally. They're equals, and that they're like very loving and intimate together. And it's not just like, oh, I'm banging my coworker.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And also that he actually cares about her having pleasure. Like I know it's a really dumb thing to say, but it's like he actually cares that at the end of end of this, she's had a good time, you know? So, but that's what I also, in all of the craziness, I love that you got to tell that story, because in all of the craziness of, you know, an obsession of Michael Mann, there are genuine moments of when once he's got what he needs, that his performers, if he trusts them, can flex a muscle and just go, I'm going to improv something. And if it works, he'll take it if it's better. And I think that that's really cool. You talked about being a young man and making like young man choices, or like gut feel of like, this doesn't really work. And then like now you as a filmmaker can go, that doesn't work. It doesn't work. And we can advance it in another way, you know, like we can do something different in this scene. And I love that. But it should, like, Jamie Foxx should make more jokes. He should be more funny. That gives him his personality.
He's being tasked with delivering impossible lines. Like, he should have a little fun.
I know. And one's so heartbreaking as well. It's like, you don't need to go home. You like, read that.
Yeah, he's like, Alonzo, you don't need to go home. But then they immediately cut Colin Farrell, which makes me think, oh man, did he just crack up?
Yeah,
I don't know. Who knows?
Only someone like you, Bill, who's seen the dailies can go, they had to cut because he broke 84 times at the end of that line delivery. Like there are 84 takes I had to go through to get to that final one.
Yeah, I don't remember him cracking up, but I would if I had to say that.
There in the dailies, were there like different, you know, obviously different line readings? Because I know on One Heat Minute, Blake, I can't remember what episode, but there was someone talking about how Pacino would just give a different line reading every single time. And that's how you get great ass.
Yeah.
I have a very bizarre answer for this.
Okay.
Qualify the story, it's Michael said that Al did about 6 takes of every scene and he had it always within 6. He said every take. And then so he would do 6. And then once he had it, Al would look at Michael and go, you've got it? And he's like, I've got it. And he's like, cool, let's do some wild ones. And then he would give as many as he wanted where he was just off the reservation. And that's where he got. That's where he got some of the best lines in the whole movie.
Now, I don't remember anything quite like that. However, there was a line where they are going to, they're over at dude's apartment. The guy that says, I'm going from zero to high order violence.
Eddie Marzen. I can't remember the character's name, but.
That's what I'm trying to think, yeah. So there is just a throwaway line.
Nicholas, my ace.
Nicholas, that's it. Yeah. Nicholas. But there, and talk about a scene that just has incredible lines in it. But
we love that scene.
It's incredible. Like Colin Farrell just stares out to sea. Like it's amazing. But there, one of the agents who has like one or two lines in the whole movie is sitting toward the back. And they say, you know, Naomi Harris is like, we're going to lock you up, whatever. And this white dude in the back just goes, yeah. And then we can watch, the Marlins on this 74-inch plasma.
Yeah.
Dominic Lombardi?
No, it's Justin Theroux. Justin Theroux.
Yes, all right. So I was like, that is the dumbest line of all time. But I just remember like take after take of that thing. And I was just so befuddled. why they were trying to nail that line. I don't know.
That is actually so amazing. I thought it was that line.
And what's so good is the line that they land on in the final cut of the movie, it is really bored delivery. Like he's not doing it. There's nothing cooking with that line. He's just like, then we can kick back and watch Marlins and the 75-inch plasma. He's dead inside. He must have gotten to 30 takes to Miller. I'm dead inside, Michael. That's what I wanted. That's exactly what I wanted.
That scene just has everything.
That we love that scene. I'm obsessed with Eddie Marzan's accent. Actually, maybe you can help us with this because I think his accent is like the big red chicken from Looney Tunes.
Foghorn Leghorn. Foghorn Leghorn.
Yes. Oh, wow. Okay.
But Michael Mann on the commentary is like, Eddie Marzan is doing a New Orleans accent. And I'm like, is he?
No, he's not. I don't know what he's doing.
I don't know what he's doing. Live
from New Orleans, Bill's like, absolutely not. That is not.
I've seen this movie a lot, and that had never once occurred to me.
Okay. I think it's more in the Foghorn Leghorn.
Yeah.
But no, we love Eddie Marzan and he's an amazing actor, but we also love how out of pocket this performance is. And it's for like 5 minutes, but it's memorable.
But it's one of my favorites. Yeah.
I think that's the luxury that I wish for you, Bill, in every movie that you and Turner make forever, is being able to hire like a guy who can crush for like two scenes and they just knock it out of the park. And you're like that. That's like an award-winning actor right there who just comes in for like 2 minutes to deliver a clearly not New Orleans accent. just like for 2 minutes. And then you're like, see, Eddie. And he's like gone. Like, it's like, that's when you know you're making big movies, when you can hire someone who's like clearly a lead in other movies to come in for 30 seconds of two scenes and is gone. Like,
I'm going to have to go back and watch this scene again with this in mind.
Oh, and
is it,
and I don't want to get her name wrong because sometimes I've forgotten. Is it Gina Rodriguez? Gina Rodriguez?
Her line.
If you can't do crime, if you can't do your time, don't do the crime. Yeah. It's so good.
What?
It's so good.
Yeah.
So good.
Wow.
That, yeah. And first, Naomi Harris's line that is like, because you lead a life of crime.
Yeah.
And then Elizabeth Rodriguez. Sorry. She's like,
Elizabeth
Rodriguez. She's like, and yeah, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime. So good. That whole scene is amazing.
Yeah, so many highlights from that scene for me. It might be one of my favorites. And also, I mean, yeah, and that's the thing about this movie is like it's all these moments, these really memorable moments and scenes that you just sort of like really hone in on the details of it and then they all kind of come together. But for me, it's like the movie is just this like series of moments in time that you just sort of like live through and you're fully present in.
That scene has a crazy choreography, right? Like the whole movie has a crazy choreography, but like everyone's doing.
Yeah, I actually had to cut that scene as well, and it was very tough to cut. Now I didn't really know what I was doing at that point, but it was pretty tough because of all the people in the scene. They're moving around,
and everyone's like stationed in like a weird like Dominic is like behind the bar complaining about the glasses being dirty, like Colin Farrell's at the window, like everybody's kind of like in weird positions around the room.
And it does, and it's not like a traditional like a sort of sweeping camera arc where it goes around the room where everyone kind of gets their moment and then it comes back around. It's like boom, 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 and the dialogue's all coming at the same time, and you know, Jamie Foxx is
moves around and claps by his ear.
Yes.
So do you feel like there are like lessons about filmmaking and editing that you like took from just like interacting with these dailies and like
I think it was the first time that I realized that you could find some sort of balance in between, you know, standard Hollywood filmmaking and like, you know, yes, there's a script or whatever, but they are oftentimes shooting it like a doc. And you know, seeing the daily showed me that, you know.
That's cool.
So that was a pretty cool lesson. And not long after that, at this trailer house I was working at, you know, they were laying off, you know, these TV spots or whatever to go to, you know, all the different versions to go to all the different studios. They'd lay them off to sometimes mini DV tapes. And every day I'd steal like one or two. And about a year after the Miami Vice trailer, I went and shot our first movie on all these mini DV tapes.
Amazing.
Yeah, working at this trailer house was kind of my film school. So
yeah, definitely.
Thank you for allowing me to revisit this time in my life.
So was that 4, 5, 3, 6, 5 that you shot? Amazing. Yeah. I love that movie.
And look, I want to know that when you got the mini DV tapes that you put on a balaclava and spoke in a Haitian accent. That's what I actually want to know. Like, did you do that, Bill? Because then we really know that the trailer stuck with you. You did a score like Miami Vice.
For the purposes of this podcast, I'm going to say yes.
No, that's so cool, man. Oh, it's been such a treat to talk to you, Bill.
I'm so glad we got to like talk I'm about so the glad. Experience of
so glad.
This trailer and getting all the details. And
look, when you guys mentioned this, it was in the middle of lockdown, and yeah. I looked at my partner. I was like, oh my God. And she was like, what? And I told her basically everything I just told you. And she was a little confused, but she was like so happy for me.
I'm really happy for you. So much to me. Amazing. Yep. Well, thank you for sharing all of that with us. It enhances the experience of the movie even more.
and Bill, yeah, look, this might have been fun for you, but I've been over, you know, in heat parlance, over fucking whelmed with how happy I am hearing your stories about this production and everything that you did with it and how much joy you had doing it and what it then spawned in your career, man. It's freaking awesome. So thank you so much for being a part of the show. This is better than we could have imagined. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Are you like Peggy Kitty? This is awesome.
Save big money on everything for your next project at Menards. Spring is here, making it the perfect time for outdoor projects. Suncast storage sheds are an excellent solution for protecting outdoor lawn and gardening tools. They're easy to assemble, and the all-weather construction provides water resistance and UV protection. Say big on Suncast storage sheds. View our selection of Suncast products today in-store and on Menards.com. Save big.